All right, so moving right along, we're going to come up on item five. And this is going to be our review of total portfolio performance for the period ending December 31, 2021. I know we're going to be joined by Scott and Tim, I believe. There's Mr. Whalen. I see him joining us. There's Mr. Price. So, Tim, when you are ready, I will turn it over to you to do the intro to bring on Scott.
So- sure. And I will just do that immediately. We have the fourth quarter performance slightly delayed here. So I will let Scott run through that. And just one caveat that the world has changed rather dramatically since the end of 2021. So, some of what you're going to hear is a little bit out of context at this point, but I'm sure Scott can provide some context on current market conditions as well.
Yeah. Good morning, Scott. I would just echo the sentiment about things have changed a lot. And I think for our purposes, it won't do as much good to spend any real time on things that have either changed or, shifted forward in different ways. So I want us to focus on the sort of what's real in here and now. So with that intro, good morning.
The floor is yours. I appreciate that. Good morning. Things have changed quite a bit. So the performance report that we provided for the period ending 12/31 and the economic review for sure is somewhat outdated. Some of the things still remain relevant, and I will try to cover those very briefly in my economic review before moving on to performance, which also, of course, is backward looking and it ends at a period where things have changed quite a bit. So really there's three things. If I were giving this presentation a couple of months ago, I would have talked just about two things, but the three things are inflation and rates, and then the COVID pandemic. And of course, the third thing now is the Russian invasion of Ukraine, which has changed things considerably and moved them down a path that we were already heading. And I'll take each of those three things sort of in order. Talking first about inflation and rates, back in November, Fed Chairman Powell's testimony to the Senate, he really made a change in direction, a pretty significant change in direction, talking about inflation and previously how it was a transitory issue, and he changed his language, talking about it being more sustained and how he was concerned about inflation. And that was really a big shift, and the markets at that time, back in November, 5 months ago, then started worrying about inflation and worrying about rate increases. Of course, rate increases have an impact on investors' portfolios, both in fixed income and equities and across portfolios, but that's when the market started to sort of perk their ears up and started thinking more about inflation and rate increases. At the same time, COVID was coming under control, going from pandemic to endemic, and we were starting to see the economy opening up more, and so you had these tensions between inflationary pressures and concerns that rates would rise versus the positive benefits of the economy opening up. And you could actually see that in the markets, interestingly, and sort of a new dynamic where as people were more concerned about inflation and rising rates, you'd see growth stocks pulling back. And when they became more concerned about the economy not opening up and not moving forward, you would see value stocks pulling back. So you saw different parts of the market advancing or pulling back depending on what day of the week it was and whether investors were more concerned about inflationary pressures or economic growth. Just a real quick aside, inflationary pressures have a more negative impact on growth stocks, right? Because inflation leads to higher interest rates. Higher interest rates, you're discounting those big earnings growth, that big earnings growth, you're discounting that back to a lower present value. So when the market's worried about inflation and rate rises, you saw growth stocks pulling back. When they're worried about more about economic growth, you saw value stocks pulling back. That was sort of the environment we were heading into as Russia was building up their forces on the Ukraine border. And then, of course, the invasion. And, you know, it's just a horrible human tragedy over there, of course. And from an economic perspective, it's having a big impact as well. So the risks now seem quite a bit multiplied in terms of geopolitical risk around, you know, the major powers in the world competing for global dominance. You've got Russia that really wants to see the world go back to a powerful Soviet Union. And by Russia, I mean President Putin. You've got China very interested in regional and global hegemony having their system become the dominant global system. And of course, you've got America and American allies wanting to maintain the status quo. And so these big global forces are playing out and sort of less strategically and more tactically, the invasion of Ukraine is having is exacerbating the supply chain effects that we felt coming out of COVID, where we had more demand than supply. Of course, a lot of commodities in terms of energy and agriculture come out of that region, and that is going to continue to impact the supply chain, exacerbating inflationary fears, and now there's talk about stagflation. So with all that as sort of forward to the investment performance, what you got and what you can expect, I'll pause there and just open it up for questions.
Any questions for Scott on the foregoing? I do not see any hands up, Scott, so continue. Okay.
Sorry, it took me a minute to unmute.
Yeah.
Scott, somewhere in all of your materials, and I didn't mark it, so I don't have it in front of me, you show a nice chart or a nice set of numbers where the Federal Reserve balance sheet goes up $100 billion a month. And it plugs right along during all this period when we're fighting inflation. Is that in fighting inflation, in your opinion, that is those increases in the money supply?
No, so absolutely not, right? It's a lot of that liquidity is what has led to the economic recovery, both from the global financial crisis and from the COVID shock back in the first quarter of 2020. So it was the Fed pumping an enormous amount of liquidity into the system, as well as through fiscal policy, right? Just handing out checks to folks that were going through tough times. And so that maintained the demand. And of course, people weren't working, so there was no supply to fill that demand. So both of those were inflationary. And now the Fed is starting to rectify that, right? They began tapering and stopped that money supply growth this month. And now they're talking about letting all the funds, all the liquidity that they've pumped into the market sort of bleed off. And they're also raising interest rates. They have raised a quarter point. They're talking about raising a half point at the next opportunity. And then the market is expecting for all of 2021, 8.5 quarter point increases throughout the rest of the year. So to answer your question, simply no, it does not help inflation, but they're trying to rectify that now through multiple means.
All right, any other questions for Scott? I don't see any, so go right ahead, sir.
Okay, so I think it's a good time to share my screen. And I see it says that I am disabled participant screen sharing. So I'm guessing that somebody will allow me to screen share. Let me know when I have that capability.
Looking for Christina, if you're on, if you could allow Scott to share screen.
We're working on it.
Okay.
Okay, here we go. So I'm going to take you to slide 2 of the second section of the deck, which, again, we're looking backwards now to the period ending 12/31. And you can see that you started the quarter with $11.3 billion. You had a cash outflow of 112. good investment performance in the fourth calendar quarter of last year, leaving you with $11.5 billion. You can see that graphically down here. And then you can see the full year, you started the 12 months at just over $10 billion. For the full year, negative outflow of $54 million, and then just a solid returns year of $1.4 billion. I'll take you to high-level performance and talk to you about the total fund and the individual sleeves. So the total fund for the quarter, 3.1%, below the policy index of 4.2%. The underperformance came in the growth portfolio, underperformed there, 4.2 versus 5.7, and then the diversifying portfolio, negative 0.3 versus 0.5. For the full year, a little bit of underperformance as well there, 13.9%, a strong year, but below the policy index of 15.3, and primarily in the growth portfolio there. So looking at attribution on the next slide, so that you can see in the growth portfolio, it was a selection effect and largely related to a couple of managers there. And we'll talk about that in a moment. But you can see that the underperformance has to do with your managers and how they pick the stocks in their portfolios. Not hugely concerned about any one quarter and underperformance relative to the benchmark based on manager selection. But we are going to talk a little bit about one of your managers momentarily. And then another point back on performance, as you know, and as we've talked about, your portfolio is designed really for downside protection. You may recall back in the first quarter of 2020, when everything was falling apart, your portfolio held up quite well. And we would expect that in markets that are ripping, like what happened in 2021, you guys would underperform. I think that you're used to that type of performance now. And we would also expect the quarter that we're currently in, you should see good relative results as we move forward in a challenged environment. So you protect on the downside so that you have more of your assets to rebuild on when things turn. Looking at individual performance, for the sake of brevity, I'm really just going to focus on one manager here, Jackson Square. You can see their underperformance for the quarter drove a fair bit of the overall underperformance in the growth portfolio. So they were about 1,100 basis points behind the benchmark. And if you look back over time, you can see their underperformance over longer periods as well. We advise patients with underperforming managers, unless there are several yellow or red flags that give us an indication that manager's time has come. With Jackson Square, you know, there are no big yellow flags with respect to the alignment of interests or their process or their philosophy. And in fact, Tim and I spoke with our equity director of manager research just this week and walked through, I spoke with him and then spoke with Tim and walked through sort of the performance and the performance expectations. And there have been times when their performance has not aligned with expectations. There is another yellow flag that they're losing some assets. And so I know staff is right now in the middle of an assessment of what to do with Jackson Square, and just wanted to bring that to your attention. And with that, really, that is the extent of my comments on performance, given that we've ended a quarter where performance was great, and we're heading into a quarter where we're expecting performance to be challenged, with the only issue really being around Jackson Square.
All right. Let's just take a quick pause and see if there are any questions of Scott before he proceeds. I'm not seeing any.
I have one quick question, Scott. Yes, on that slide that you just had up that had the total fund return for it, it showed the 1 year as 14.2.
Yeah.
On the executive summary page, it showed 13.9 for the 1 year total.
Oh, so that's the difference between gross and net of fees.
Net of fees.
And gross of fees for the manager performance page so that we can compare them to other manager universe.
Got it. Thanks.
Louis.
Just a quick question. We still, on private equity, they're still lagged by 3 months on their performance reporting?
That's right.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Any other questions of Scott? Seeing none, go ahead, Scott.
Mr. Chairman, that concludes my report.
Well, you know, when we say we want to kind of focus on what matters, you focused on what matters. So thank you. I do see a hand up, Jerry.
I had one question, Scott. If,
yes, sir.
I don't necessarily have to call your attention to the page, but it's under a heading called housing. And I'm reminded of an expression one of my college professors enjoyed using, a statement that is fraught with portent. This talks about the pressures on housing, but this seems to be a statement that begs a lot of questions. Much higher living costs may lead to further social unrest. Good grief. Could you expand on what you think social, and I understand it's going to be a topic of discussion, but can you explain what the author had in mind when he or she decided this was going to lead to social unrest?
So, so further social unrest, right? So we are seeing social unrest, and there is a big dispersion between the haves and have-nots in our society. The have-nots, not so much having equity interest in home ownership, and home prices have increased dramatically over the last year, couple of years, really in the last year. I mean, you've seen double digit in the 20 and 30% range just in the last year alone, depending on the market that you're looking at. And so that's really the concern, is the continued dispersion between the haves and the have-nots leading to, you know, further problems.
The disparity, I get, that's easily chartable and understandable and supportable. I was just a little concerned about how broad that statement was, suggesting that there would be rioting in the streets.
Yeah, So I guess, yeah, so it may be sort of an inflammatory point of verbiage that wasn't really necessary. I don't think that rioting in the streets is the concern, but it's hard to argue that we're not having some social unrest and real difficulty in different folks coming to a meeting of the minds.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Scott. Any other comments or questions?
Yes. I want to at least give Jerry some comfort. It is not the sellers who are rioting.
not the sellers of homes, is that
right? Of homes, right. the second, clearly one of the ways we benefit from your services, Scott, is that you see a variety of other plans similar to ours. How do we compare broadly? Are there best practices that others are following that we might? Are there things we are doing that we might reconsider?
Yeah. So interestingly, you know, you guys were sort of at the forefront of the functionally focused portfolio structure in your portfolio. And that's becoming more and more of a topic of conversation as folks with maturing plans know that they need to watch their liquidity very closely to be able to pay increasing benefits and their negative net cash and accommodate their negative net cash flows. At the same time that nobody is really willing to significantly lower their return expectations to the point where they have quite a bit less risk in the portfolio due to their liquidity constraints. So we're seeing more interest in the functionally focused portfolio that you guys put in place 5+ years ago. So that's one comment. Another comment is we are seeing more folks move towards private markets, private credit and private equity, because that's where the returns have been. That's where the expected returns are coming from, and trying to figure out how to accommodate that additional illiquidity in their portfolio. You know, concerns that I have, and I speak to managers about this all the time, is the increased interest is leading to increased investments, which of course ought to lead to lower future expected returns. And that the returns that investors got from their private markets portfolios in the past may not be the same going forward. But that's, you know, that's always a concern.
It's a pretty popular disclaimer, right? Past performance is no guarantee of future performance.
I've said it a few times.
Jay, you had your hand up. Oh, I'm sorry, Jerry first and then Jay.
I just want to follow up if I could please with another question. Obviously, looking back is an important thing to do, but we spend a lot of time trying to anticipate what's coming in the future. There's the Russian fiasco is nothing less than a horrible human tragedy. I'm concerned about hearing some of your comments on China. China seems to me to be an incredible potential out there. I think there's a comment in your report that suggests that 30% of the economy in China is based upon housing, real estate, whatever it might be. And it doesn't sound like China is in great shape. So on a going forward basis, what kind of questions do you think we should be trying to get answers to regarding current Chinese exposure and possible future Chinese exposure or lack thereof?
Well, so there's an economic question and there's a political question, right? I'll address the political question first. So, you know, I was at a conference a couple months back. I was talking to a guy named Jonathan Ward, one of those really smart guys who just digs deep into his topic and becomes an expert on it. You know, he's consulted with presidents and joint chiefs of staff, and he's all about the China threat, the geopolitical China threat. And he was at this conference trying to figure out how to make institutional investors aware that, you know, they ought to be using their leverage that they have by virtue of the assets that they control to try to impact China and the global threat. And, you know, he paints a pretty bleak picture of long-term, that China is aiming for long-term global dominance and is directing their attention right at the throat of America. So there's that, right? The other aspect is the financial or the investment aspect. And there's always been risks with China, but there are folks out there that look at China as a real investment opportunity. Some very smart investors, Bridgewater being one of them. Now, Bridgewater, if you follow what they say, and by the way, as a very quick aside, Ray Dalio, who is the leader of Bridgewater, you know, 50-year successful investor, one of the real icons in the investment management community. He put together, he thinks about these big global items, and he put together this 50-minute cartoon that I would encourage you to watch if you have the time. And it goes through the cycles of regime change, you know, the long-term cycles of regime change, going back through history and looking at a number of really good examples going back hundreds of years, and pointing out that it tracks the same curve, right? And talking about you know, the British Empire, and now up to the US, and talking about how they track the same curves, and talks about where we are on all the characteristics that show that cycle of empire. So if you just are interested, it's entertaining and very informative. It's a 50-minute time commitment, and you could just Google Ray Dalio cartoon and it would come right up on YouTube. Anyway, that aside.
Spoiler alert, it's not uplifting.
It's not uplifting, if you've seen that. Although, you know, I will say that there are a number of ways that, so there are a number of ways that it could end differently than what he implies, for sure, right?
Agreed.
I just, one of the things that I get concerned about is that China is a command and control economy, no question about it. They can, in my opinion, they can turn on a dime and make it very difficult, if not impossible, to repatriate investment funds, and just on a whim. So that concerns me, and seems to me something we ought to be trying to keep an eye on as to whether or not it's worth having the exposure we currently have, or whether we should minimize that. It's one thing to say that it's a great investment opportunity. It's another thing to say, sorry, you can't get your money back.
Yeah, no, that's true. And all emerging markets carry similar risks. China, you know, they have been very interested in gaining credibility for their financial markets and shutting out foreign investors. They spent decades trying to gain credibility for their financial markets. Shutting out foreign investors like that would really hurt. Now, it could come to that should global conflict, you know, start moving towards a hot war and global conflict lead to that. But I think absent that, you probably wouldn't see China shutting out international investors to the extent that they would lose lots of money. That would not be in their self-interest. But there are certainly challenges in Chinese investing. I mean, and it is part of that command and control economy where, you know, a lot of these really wealthy tech entrepreneurs have, you know, frankly, pissed off the Chinese Communist Party, and they're making life difficult for them, which is causing the value of a lot of these high flying tech firms. Some of them have lost 75-80% of their value. And that's hurt, of course, other investors that are invested in those same companies.
So, yeah, you don't have to be a tech firm. You could be Jack Ma.
I was just going to say, when's the last time you heard anything from Jack Ma?
Yeah.
Right. So, yeah. So, so there are certainly risks, not only political risks, regulatory risks like that, but economic risks, to your point. Real estate firms, real estate investments have had trouble as well because of the perceived overinvestment and leverage in the real estate market. And those firms have been hurt, and that's rippled through the economy. Another thing that is of interest is their policies and approach to COVID has been different, right? They've had zero tolerance. And they shut the economy down when they see these flare-ups. They shut regional economies down. They lock them down. And that is having implications on their economy and broader implications on the supply chain. And it'll be interesting to see how all that plays out. So certainly risks, your investment managers that invest in that region are more aware of those than I, and hopefully are managing them as well.
I just want to, I guess I'm making a too long a case to suggest I'd like to make sure that we're looking at this actively as opposed to reacting to it at some later date and inventorying the investments, looking at the exposures, and maybe even looking at possible off-ramps.
Well, that might be a nice segue because I'm mindful of the time, and I want to be sure that in light of our schedule constraints that I want to get to make sure we take on item 5B and 6 while we have Tim Price here. So if there's no further questions of Scott, thank you. Very interesting. Stay tuned, I guess. And Tim, if you want to address the last comment, feel free, of course, and then why don't you take 5B and then 6 afterwards?
Sure. And maybe we can just, you know, I think the situation in Russia and the certainly the knock-on effects of all emerging markets have caused a reassessment of geopolitical risk. And, you know, I'll be candid that there are more questions than answers at this point. But, you know, I think, you know, there is an expectation of countries that were included in the MSCI Emerging Market Index had basic functional financial systems, and we're fairly well integrated into the global financial system. And that provided some comfort to a lot of investors over the past 20 years to begin allocations to these markets in earnest. You know, I think Russia was always a little bit of a difficult fit into that economy or into that kind of global system because, you know, it was not a command and control economy, but certainly a centralized political force economy. And, you know, the companies that were successful in Russia certainly seemed to be aligned with the Kremlin's goals. And so you had, you know, a strong alignment there. And that creates difficult conversations when the government is taking actions that are contrary to our government and our goals as investors. Trustee Holcomb, I mean, your questions about China are the questions we have been asking as well. You know, it's one thing to take the 11th largest economy out of the global financial system, that's Russia. Taking China out of the global financial system would cause repercussions that candidly are more than sobering to contemplate, both with direct holdings in China and manufacturing-based, natural resource-based. That would be a traumatic experience for all financial systems globally. And I think the likelihood of that is lower, but certainly it's non-zero. And whenever we take a look at emerging markets, we always take a look at, you know, how locked in do we want to be with these investments? And I think that's part of the reason why we've been comfortable, historically with deploying public equity that was tradable into these markets, but we haven't been comfortable providing, you know, real estate. We've had a very minimal exposure to emerging markets. And within private equity, we've had zero exposure. So the lockups there has not been something we've been comfortable with. I think we recognize that all investments sit on a spectrum of risk. There is a cutoff point, and historically that has been, you know, private market lockups in these emerging markets, just given how much can change in an emerging economy over a decade or so. The fact that emerging means their forward path is less certain than developed markets, and we haven't been willing to deploy long-term lockups there. So I think it is a area of active assessment. We need to keep in mind that China is roughly a quarter of the emerging market index. So it's a huge chunk of that that portion of the at least of the investable universe there, and it's a different kind of conversation when we start to talk about that. But you know, we have talked with our managers about what their views are around China, where they're positioned within China. We've talked with some managers about creating an ex-China version of the products. Nobody has gone down that path yet, but those are conversations that are happening in the background. So with that, let me share my screen and we can address 5B in more detail here. That is not what we want. One moment. There we go. Is everyone seeing the memo?
Yeah, if you could increase its size.
Yep.
I mean, I can bring it up on my device as well, but
there we go. So again, given that the fourth quarter is close to 90 days ago and the world has changed so dramatically, I will run through this fairly briefly, but answer any questions that trustees have. Just a quick reminder, this is the complimentary report to Verus's report that we issue on a quarterly basis that really answers two different questions in our mind. It's one, how well is each one of the sub portfolios meeting its kind of goals that are more expansive than just a performance benchmark goal? And second, whether the complexity of the implementation, the use of private markets, different asset classes, if that's gaining us stronger risk-adjusted returns.
Tim?
Yes.
I don't think you're showing the memo. It seems like you might be showing your desktop and notes. So if you could maybe stop sharing and then try again.
You actually had the memo up earlier.
Yeah.
Okay. It's not what I'm seeing on my... Let me try this again.
Maybe.
Are you seeing the memo now?
Page 2 of it.
That's odd because I see my notes, but okay, we'll go with this. As long as you're seeing the memo, that's the important part here. Okay. So let's go to page 3 there. This is a report card on the functional operations of each one of the sub portfolios and just kind of answers the big questions of what's working. As we've talked about in the past, the liquidity program, I'm sorry, before I go on, Jerry, you had a question?
No.
Jerry, your hand's up.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay.
I just keep it up all the time.
That's fair.
I just lowered it. Sorry.
All right. Fair enough. In terms of the big picture goals here, the liquidity program, which is really intended to be high quality, matching our expected benefit payments and keeping that duration within a short band, is meeting all of our expectations there. It is AA-, under 2 years of duration and matching 31 months. You'll recall that last year, the board took action to reduce the size of the liquidity program from, you know, up to 48 months to up to 36 months. So you're seeing these lower numbers now. And then this will get refreshed come July. Within the growth portfolio, we'd say, you know, from an absolute return perspective, the 12.5% return over the past 5 years is meeting expectations. You know, the return relative to the global equity index, that's what the ACWI index is, is, you know, trailing it by about 1.9%. This is somewhat to be expected given that we have a more defensive posture and you've had just a ripping growth equity market. But we do want to keep an eye on that. But yeah, you know, the other thing we closely track here is, are we deploying capital efficiently? And that's a Sharpe ratio measure. And on that basis, we're still have a superior Sharpe ratio to the index. 1.1 versus 0.8 over the last 5 years. It just means for every unit of risk we're taking, we're getting a stronger reward for that relative to the global stock index. Risk diversifying. This one is a little bit of a, you know, we're gonna have to wait and see on this. We've restructured it over the past 18 months. So you're looking at the legacy impact of positions.
Excuse me.
You know, over the past couple of years, we have added Acadian's product. We have added SITS, defensive fixed income product. We have late last year eliminated the parametric volatility risk premium model. So you're looking at a lot of historical numbers here, which might not be as indicative of where we're going to take this program going forward. We would note that the portion of the portfolio that was driving the higher correlation than we wanted to see was the parametric strategy. Now that that's come out, the remaining strategies have lower correlations. And then on the positive real returns, you know, some of that is legacy managers having a little bit of an underperformance relative to expectations. And candidly, some of that is just the inflationary environment we're in. You know, when we had 3% inflation, I think that was probably more in line with what the managers were able to target. When we have 8% inflation, it's a very difficult period for these types of defensive strategies to keep up in. But we would note that, you know, if you fast forward to the first quarter of this year, the defensive portion, the risk diversifying portion of the portfolio did offer significant protection in the January period. I think the index was down, or the equity index was down 6%, and this was down 1%. So we are seeing that defensive nature come into the fore in the current market environment. Let me pause there for questions before we take a quick look at each one of the sub-portfolios in more detail.
I don't see any hands up. I think we're good.
All right. So let's take a look at liquidity. There's this is all short duration, high quality fixed income. So you wouldn't expect a lot of surprises, and we don't see a lot of surprises here. Everybody has been fairly stable. You know, we saw the SIP product growth decline a little bit. That was two strategies that you know, they lost two clients to other, one to another SIT fixed income strategy and one to a merger. So we don't see any significant issues in that number. Now, the eagle-eyed among you have spotted the error on this page, and that is SIT does not have a one-year total return of 60%. I wish that was the case. There was a fat-fingered error there. That should be at 0.3%. Unfortunately, that slipped through the quality control process, but we'll get that corrected. On page 5, taking a look at just, you know, everybody in the growth portfolio on terms of kind of where they're at from an asset growth standpoint. The thing that really jumps out here again is Jackson Square with the negative 68% product asset growth. You'll recall they lost a Vanguard sub-advisory relationship last year. That was about half of their asset base at the time. They've since had two corporate plans, you know, go to more of a risk, you know, two corporate plans that were fairly well funded, exit some of their equity positions. And so, you know, we think there's a story there, but we are still reassessing the manager based upon their performance track record, less based on this decline in product assets. And that we can see on page 6. You know, I think there's a lot going on this page, but you'll notice that the one that we note is not meeting expectations is Jackson Square. So more to come on that one. I would call out that, you know, total domestic equity is still putting up a 15% 10-year return. Very solid. Total international still putting up an 8% and global right in between at 12%. So those are meeting long-term expectations there. One other thing that kind of jumps out on the page is the TT emerging market 1-year return of negative 1%. This is a growth-oriented strategy, and we were simply seeing kind of a retrenchment last year within emerging markets. Long-term, they're still putting up solid numbers. They just, you'll recall about a year ago, the value index or the value manager PIMCO was massively underperforming TT, and that just kind of reversed, but the long-term numbers still play out there. If we go to page 9 on risk diversifying, again, this is a little bit of a moving target here because of the restructuring. But the managers are all in fairly good shape from a product growth and asset growth standpoint. You know, the correlation numbers are all directionally correct if we take Parametric out of that mix. And we did right at year end. So I think their liquidation kind of rolled over the course of the end of the year. So began in December, ended in January. So you won't see that going forward. And, you know, the SIT strategy was funded in the second quarter of 2021. So, and that's a custom strategy. So we're still waiting for some additional data to come in there to be able to draw the cross comparisons. But you put that all together into the total fund, and this is kind of the pattern we look to see here. Are we capturing more of the upside and less of the downside? And that gap is what we want to maintain. Obviously, that gap had closed. In recent years, we're starting to see that gap expand again. So directionally, that's what we want to see. We want to be capturing more of the upside, less of the downside. Now, we're not capturing 100% of the upside because we are defensive by nature, but we want to maintain that spread. And that is the protective spread. Both of those numbers are under 100% with the upside capture higher than the downside capture. So this is a type of period where in the first quarter of 2020, when the COVID outbreak was first happening, we saw that protection really pay off. Now in the first quarter of 2022, when we're seeing geopolitical risks spike up, we expect, you know, the downside protection to help us here as well. And the final page I touch on here is just we take a look in that second table. Our absolute returns relative to a simple target index, the volatility relative to the simple target index. And then that last line is really what we focus on there. Are we getting higher risk adjusted returns than just putting into simple indices? And over 1, 3, 5, and 10 years, you see that the Sharpe ratio is higher than that simple target index. So that says, you know, we are efficiently deploying capital on an absolute basis. We're outperforming the simple target index on a 1-year and 10-year basis, a little bit of underperformance over the 3-year and 5-year periods. Some of that is coming from the build out of private equity, where we're still trying to get up to our allocations there. And that has been a strong performer. I think Scott didn't touch on it during the prior presentation, but we've had, Scott, what was it, a plus 60% year in private equity in 2021?
Yeah, something like that. It's private equity was the big outperformer.
Yeah, a massive outperformer. Now, that doesn't show up in our benchmark relative results because we benchmark private markets to themselves. But I think it's worth calling out that we had, you know, private equity really, really contribute strongly to the performance last year. So part of that is the build out of private equity, and part of that is the challenges we've had within domestic equity that we've discussed here. But
60.4% is the number.
60.4%. So an incredibly strong private equity year.
It's impressive.
Yeah. That would be conclude my prepared remarks on the fourth quarter, which is ancient history by now, but certainly I'm happy to address any trustee questions.
Any questions, additional questions for Tim? I don't see any. Tim?
I'd like to make it clear that even I don't have one.
Yes, Jerry. Yeah. No, I'm going to call the East Bay Times. We'll get a press release out on that.
All right. Maybe I'll just touch briefly on an update to the Russian situation, since I have a hard stop in about 10 minutes, but I can give you that briefly before moving to item six. And that the update is there's not a whole lot of update. Both of our emerging markets managers have expressed their desire to exit the remaining positions. The Moscow exchange remains closed. The new information this week is they started trading local bonds on Monday. They put a short selling ban on the equity market on Tuesday. And just a couple of hours ago, they announced they're going to open for limited trading tomorrow, but it's for locals only. And, you know, it really is, you know, not for us. They're still not settling trades from foreigners, and we still don't know if the clearinghouse Euroclear is going to settle Russian trades. So more to come, but there is progress towards reopening there. But it's really still a frozen asset from our perspective.
All right. I don't see any other hands up.
Oh, Mr. Chair, that's my prepared comments on this portion.
So that's 5B, correct?
That's 5B.
All right. So thank you. And let's